Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, I am joined by Alice Hodgson. Alice is the founder and managing director of Train the Crowd. And it was really interesting to hear more about Alice's journey, both before the training world and also before she found her way into the Salesforce ecosystem. We talk about how Alice's Salesforce journey has evolved and what gave her the confidence to set up a specialized Salesforce training business a number of years ago. We then look at how the Salesforce market has evolved and how Alice and her business have had to adapt and keep up with the complexity and ever-changing Salesforce ecosystem. We hear more about the role of a trainer and how important Salesforce platform knowledge is when delivering Salesforce training, and also if Alice feels it's a mistake to sometimes bundle the training role under someone else's responsibilities. We look at how COVID has changed the role of a trainer and also hear more about what Alice loves about being a business owner and what excites her about the future. So a really interesting episode to find out more about someone that's been in the Salesforce ecosystem in ANZ for a number of years now, and to find out more about what it's like to run a business in this space and the world of Salesforce training. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through. So Alice, thank you so much for joining us, Talent Hub Talk, and your first podcast, I believe, which is exciting from my side.
Yes, and from mine. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, no, our pleasure. So I'm really excited to hear more about your journey and the business that you run, and also dig a little bit deeper into the topic of training, because I think obviously that's your expertise. And I think it's a topic in the market that perhaps people need to understand more of, or need to understand the trends or the skills that it takes to be a really good trainer. So we'll go through all of that. But what I'd like to understand first is a bit about your earlier career and life before Salesforce and kind of what you did in your early days of your career.
Yeah. So at university, I studied IT and commerce. And maybe interestingly, why I even went into IT was when I was at high school. I did high school in Far North Queensland. My principal introduced laptops for us at year nine. And I don't even know if Sydney schools at that time were using laptops. So there, sort of in year 11 and 12, I had a subject where you could do information programming. And so I joined that. And I really liked it. I mean, we weren't a family at home who had computers and things. So my exposure was through school. And it probably wasn't, if it wasn't for that, I probably wouldn't have done IT at university and probably wouldn't be where I am today. So, I'm very grateful for, you know, early days being introduced. And I think it's amazing for kids to be introduced to technology pretty early, especially these days. And so, yeah, after university, I went to work at PwC Consulting, where I learned, so probably first got introduced to sort of IT consulting world, where I was doing things like system testing was probably the first project everyone gets put on. That moved into to more consulting, and I then got asked to be an instructor on their graduate training program. As a graduate at PwC at the time, you got sent to Florida for 3 months to do a training course, and that was for people who hadn't done IT universities in other countries. They would do a really intensive three-month university IT course, basically delivered by PwC. But because we were from Australia, where we did get hired with IT backgrounds, we, you know, spent a lot of time at theme parks, going shopping with museums. And so we found that course wasn't as challenging probably as some of the other people from other countries. Then fast forward sort of a year, I then got asked to go back and teach at that course. And so spent about a year in Florida, and probably where I first found my passion for, well, definitely for IT, and also for delivering, you know, presentation style classroom and teaching students and graduates at the time of the program. And yeah, I loved it.
So was that, like, did you identify at that point that training could be a career? Like, was it already a role that people were doing as a career, or was it just something you saw as a stepping stone into perhaps something else?
Yeah, I guess at that point I probably didn't think of it as a career. I was still on the path of, you know, being an IT consultant. And then at the end of that, during the program, I might have met a guy from London who I quite fancied. He obviously goes back to London. At the time, I'd consulting in London, where people were being paid quite a lot. And so I decided to follow my heart and go to London and turn up on his doorstep and say, well, I'm here now. But at the time, yeah, it was a pretty lucrative time in London where you could get a great day rate. And I ended up being hired at an investment bank as an IT consultant. I did some sort of through, I ended up staying with them the whole time I was there. I was there for 4 years, and I did sort of became a BA. And one of the projects that we worked on was they were assessing or analyzing Salesforce as an option to swap out their custom build CRM to use that as the platform. And it was great. I mean, at the time, it was a very lightweight tool, and a lot of companies, particularly banks, weren't looking at using, you know, software in the cloud. But I guess I was lucky to learn a bit about it, and that brought me back to Sydney, because at the end of my 4 years, I decided to come back to Sydney. A little side note, actually, maybe my visa ran out and I might have been deported, but that could be that's another topic.
All the secrets are coming out now.
I went back in Sydney going, whoops-a-daisy, and ABN AMRO decided to keep me here because they needed to roll out their Salesforce instance in the Sydney office. So at that point, I'd helped being the BA, customizing it correctly to what they needed. Then we'd rolled out, just, I guess, some training along the way, but it definitely wasn't my primary role. And once that kind of got rolled out, it was a bit more BAU, and the other projects at the bank in IT that were on offer, I wasn't particularly interested in. But through that time, I'd been working with Fujitsu, who were the consulting partner. And so they were doing any changes we needed to Salesforce. And so I got to know the guys soon. And one was Ken Struthers, who has built Cloud Sherpas. He's now doing a Microsoft partner. So there's a few people in the ecosystem who I met during that time. And then at the end of that, so I was like, well, I'm not really sure what I want to do. So I took 4 months off and I did some career coaching, which I highly recommend for anyone who's sort of a bit lost. I guess you fundamentally, inside, you know what you're good at and what you like, but it's not obvious to you, and you need someone to ask you the right questions to sort of draw it out of you. And that coaching process really did that for me. And at the end, you come up with like a dream job description of what your role would look like. And for me, it was, well, I loved Salesforce. I loved the platform that we had at ABN AMRO. And I also loved the teaching I did when I was in Florida. So imagine if I could have a role that was teaching people to use Salesforce, that would be my dream job. As weird as it is when you ask the universe sometimes for things, I then go on Salesforce websites and I see the fact there was actually a Salesforce instructor role in Sydney advertised. I'm like, what are the chances of this happening? So I went through that interview process quite a lot of time. I also was at the time applying for other roles and saying no to things because this was really the one I wanted. They said, yep, great, you've got the job. And then I went, perfect, got a friend, went up to Fiji for a week, came back, and then they said, oh, actually, we've tried to get approval through Singapore office and we're not able to hire the role. So I was pretty devastated at the time, but because I'd been applying for some other contracts, there was one that came up at UBS and I was doing being a trainer on different systems. Through that, I met Alec, who ended up working with a bit, Train the Crowd, who's also gone off on he's got an amazing Salesforce career. So maybe it was all meant to be. And, you know, sometimes if you're trying to get somewhere, you don't always go the most direct path. I don't think my path was very direct at all. So then I kind of got experience doing training on systems. Also a training company offered me a role. So I went and worked more dedicated to being training, and they were doing some Salesforce courses. So the admin course, which is the ADM at the time 201, now it's the Lightning version. So I learned how to do some of those courses while working with them. And I guess at the time when I was at ABN AMRO and working with Fujitsu, the Salesforce office was tiny. There was only 5 people in Sydney. There was definitely no office in Melbourne or anywhere else. So, you know, it was quite, I guess I'd been around Salesforce for a long time, and by the time I'd kind of got to the point where I was teaching their courses, the office, there was so many more people and I'd had quite a lot of good connections. I'd also worked at Fujitsu on a few projects myself. So I was like, well, I can see that what tends to happen when you're a consultant is you go in and do the work and then you sort of show people what you've built and then you leave.
Yeah.
And then you go into your next project, you do the work and then you show them what you did and then you leave. And the bit that I liked the most, I guess I loved the BA bit, the start, what do they need, what are their requirements, but I really loved the bit at the end, which was when we actually got to showcase and train people on what we built. But that always tended to be the bit that got cut short and we never then got to see what happened afterwards. Did they start using it? Did they not? So I guess once I was working at the training company and looking, teaching the standard courses, there was a huge opportunity that I couldn't see anyone doing, which was building out custom training programs for clients where you've come in and developed the software for them. But, you know, it's not the standard course that they need. They need something that's more tailor-made to what it is that they're doing.
So at that point, when you identified this gap, was it always going to be a training business that you set up? Or did you consider doing the whole consulting piece and just having the training part on the end and doing that properly?
Yeah, great question. Because at the time I was working with a friend and I was having, you know, some romance challenges. And so we developed an app to help girls dating. And we got a partnership with RSVP. And I was thinking, well, actually, why don't I do that full time? But at the moment, it's not paying the bills. And unfortunately, it didn't become Tinder. Otherwise, it definitely would have paid the bills. Yeah. So I thought, well, why don't I? And it was a lot of encouragement from family and friends. Why don't I sort of stop working at the training company, go off and be sort of a contractor myself, continue to build out this dating app that we created, and then in the meantime I can be doing some of the training courses and do some of this other training. But I'm sort of someone who likes to do things properly. If you're going to do something, you may as well do it properly. So I did set up a company and you know, got Salesforce because you could get 2 free licenses if you at the time, and started to establish myself as if I was a company setting up and doing work, even though it was just me doing some consulting. And I figured between the two things, either the app was going to take off or I was going to do a lot of training. And the app didn't take off and I ended up doing a lot of training. So kind of how it happened.
Yeah, nice. And so obviously you had been in a consult, like you'd done some hands-on stuff with Salesforce before. So and at that point, I guess we're like it's a number of years back where there weren't as many partners in the market. So like, was it always going to be a training thing though? Or did you think, you know, we can do implementation work as well?
Training was always my passion. And yeah, there were partners who were doing implementations. And I guess when I'd done that myself, it probably wasn't the piece that I'd enjoyed the most. Yeah, I could do it, but I'm probably not a developer type of mindset really. And configuration helps that because it's a little bit easier than actually doing development work. So I guess because it wasn't my passion, I also figured in terms of a business model, if there are consulting partners out there who are not doing the training piece, then they could use us to do the training piece. So we could be that subcontractor model. So I made an intention from the start that we wouldn't do that work so that we could be a partner with the companies that did do that work and fill the gap for not only Salesforce themselves as a vendor weren't at the time providing or offering sort of custom training services. They had standard training courses, but they didn't have anything else. And the team there I knew very well, and they get constant calls from clients to say, you know, we need this help, but there was no offering. So, and also the other partners that, because I'd sort of worked at Fujitsu, and some of the other partners I'd seen that typically do a sort of a handover of the system, but not the full scale what I wanted to build out and enjoy doing the most, which was the end user training sort of scenario. So I guess I never had intended to be anything more than that, and it was more so that we could work with companies who were doing that without having any conflict.
Sure. So from the moment you formed the business, and it was kind of like a side hustle at the time for the seeing if the dating thing took off, at what point did you realize, actually, you know, this is a business, not just a side project or a woman kind of training piece? Like, yeah, when did it become train the crowd that was going to become the training partner to the Salesforce ecosystem?
Yeah, it happened pretty quickly. Probably within a month, I called up Alec and said, are you looking for anything else to do? Because I need some help over here. And I think because of the relationship I had with the Salesforce training team or Salesforce University at the time, now their team has become Trailhead, that they were getting these calls from people who were wanting not a standard ADM class, but they're wanting their users to be trained, and they didn't have anywhere to direct the call. There wasn't a service they offered. So they started calling or emailing me. So pretty quickly, my inbox filled up of lots of leads to the point where at the time I couldn't get to them all, which is a great problem to have when you're starting out. And you know, I wish that was a problem we still had, but I've overcome that one. Yeah, so, and at the same time, it was the app business is hard, and girls didn't really want to admit that they needed a dating app to help them dating. So we probably didn't do our market research well there. They just wanted to meet people, not the one that we designed. So it happened pretty quickly.
Sure. And then obviously there's been a lot of evolution with the market, not just the platform, but like the size of projects and the complexity and how people are using Salesforce. So how, from your side and from training on the platform, how have things evolved and how have you kind of had to adapt to keep up with that change?
Yeah, so I guess we've been going for nearly about 8 years now. So probably for the first 4 or 5 years, we were doing 5 to 10 day sort of engagements, as in people had a team of sales, you know, 20 to 50 salespeople who they wanted to train on Salesforce. They hadn't configured the system too much beyond leads, opportunities, accounts, contacts. So we had some templates. We had a similar thing that we do each time. It would just be their business processes and rules that we would need to add in. So the development effort of the content was fairly small, and then it was depending how big their teams were, how many days of delivery we needed to do. Then I'm not sure what changed, but it sort of within probably the last 2 or 3 years, maybe even 4 years, I guess the Salesforce as a platform evolved, and clients probably became more open to putting some of the information in the cloud, and also because of, I guess, Force.com, the platform, and being able to customize a lot more, and people being encouraged to do that, more partners coming, bigger partners, that our project started to get much bigger. I remember one project I was quite involved with, it was 333 days, I think it was. And for me, a proposal that had gone from typically was 5 to 10 days to something that we were managing, which was a 300-day engagement, was a huge leap. And internally, our systems didn't cope with that. So we had a very original version of Salesforce that we were using to manage the opportunity and then who was doing the work. We didn't have a way to manage 300 days worth of work. So Smartsheet at the time was something we'd use, and it was very clunky. So one thing I guess we had to do was come up with and reinvent our CRM. We still use Salesforce, but we teamed up with Mission Control. Colin, you might know well. And so it's been an amazing addition to Salesforce for us, and it helps to manage everything after the opportunity's won, the whole project. So it's got, you know, the project management part. It's got assigning people tasks. It's got the time sheeting, the billing, everything. So we, I guess, had to grow up. We're no longer a sort of a child trying to crawl. We're now really trying to run.
Sure.
So, yeah, and it was exciting for us. We've called it Crowd HQ. So we gave it a name, we gave it a brand, and we continue to evolve every month. We look at what else we could be adding in there. So it's really good.
Sure. And we have seen over the years that we've been recruiting the Salesforce ecosystem, we sometimes see the role of a trainer being bundled into other positions. So like an admin can do training, or we'll hire a functional consultant and part of their role will be training. In your experience, is that a mistake? Does someone need to be a specialist trainer to deliver a training piece of work?
Yeah, it's a great question. As for whether it's a mistake or is it the what that person wants to be doing in what's ordinarily part of that role, often, you know, we find often it's sort of a business analyst who understands the requirements and is probably the person who's been liaising with the users the most, who then gets asked to do some of the training. Or if it's an existing admin, yes, maybe they're asked to do it, and sometimes they're great at doing it. And it's whether that person enjoys presenting. A lot of people who have, particularly like consultants who are doing more the configuration or the setup of the system, it's not their passion to teach people or make sure that people are learning in the certain, you know, the adult learning styles that we promote. So yeah, I would suggest it's probably better suited to someone whose role and experience is in the transfer of knowledge for them to be able to perform the role, rather than their skill set lies in building the solution as opposed to transferring the knowledge to the end users. And I guess one thing I see, it's quite, we often describe it as, if you've built the system or you've been involved in that, it's like driving a car. You've built the car, you know what's under the hood, but the person who's driving the car just needs to know where the accelerator is and where the indicator is and the steering wheel. They only need to know a few things that allows them to get from A to B. They don't need to know everything else.
Sure.
So I guess a trained skill set is understanding that role, what it is they need to know, and explaining to them in, I guess, the language that they can understand. They don't need to know the full bells and whistles of how many rules and workflows and things that are in the system or all the wonderful things that have been built. They just need to know how to make it drive.
Sure. And the reason I ask that question is obviously because if you're now delivering training pieces of work that are 330 odd days long, like that's a intensive piece of work, right? That's not just something you bolt on to someone else's role. That's a big project. But then also finding people that can deliver that piece of work must also be challenging, because I would imagine that although you don't need to know the mechanics of how everything works, you still need platform knowledge, right? You need to understand Salesforce to be able to train. So
is that the truth? Do you like, could you put a trainer into that 333-day project and on day one they're just delivering some material, or do they need to know the Salesforce platform? And then if they do, what's that kind of learning curve when you hire someone into the ecosystem to get them up to the point that they're ready to deliver a piece of training like that?
Great question. And we've tried traditional just a trainer person who hasn't had exposure to Salesforce before, and it's too steep a learning curve. What we typically look for is someone who has, even if it's been an end user of Salesforce, at least had an exposure to it from, it doesn't mean you have to have been the administrator where you've gone into setup and you know how to add fields and change page layouts, but you definitely need to know how it all hangs together. And the more you've used it as an end user, the better off you're going to be, because you also bring your own stories to the table when you're teaching. I guess maybe I could answer in two ways, because we do two types of services. One is the standard courses. So we still get asked by Salesforce to deliver their curriculum, so the admin, say, 5-day course. So for someone who's going to be certified by Salesforce to teach their standard courses, I would say most definitely they need experience either being a consultant or being an in-house admin would be a great sort of fit for that role, because they're teaching people how to be the administrator of the system. And the more experience they've had of different scenarios and different clients and seeing how the system can be used in different ways, the better off they're going to offer experience and sort of also understand every time Salesforce updates 3 times a year, that course changes or there's new things that we're teaching. So someone who's quickly able to pick up the new features and be able to then translate that to teach somebody else definitely needs to have some experience and a passion for teaching. We probably don't look for people who found a cert for in teaching. It's more that I think the preference for us is they've got the technology knowledge and they have a passion and they have their own style for delivering that, and they have an interest in presenting and they're good presenters. That's probably more important than someone who's comes from a traditional training background and is standing up to teach the Salesforce class. When it's more than the other type of work we do would be the custom projects. So we'd go into a client who's configured Salesforce, and that is probably more of the BA consultant type mindset, where you need to understand the business process of who the users are, what are they trying to do. And having platform knowledge is helpful, because in the classroom, even though you can know just that system and exactly what happens when you click these buttons, all the time you'll get questions around, well, what about this and what about that and can it do this and can it do that? And so if you have a background in Salesforce from other experience, even if it's just other clients or your own background, then you're better off, or you're better positioned to be able to be convincing when you're answering those questions that are a bit out of the realm of what that client's using Salesforce for, and they're kind of looking to you to be an expert on the system as opposed to an expert trainer, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Ask, even if someone is delivering custom end user training, we still ask them to be Salesforce admin certified as a minimum, so they at least understand what the platform can do and how it can be set up. They don't ever have to be an admin potentially, but it will help for the sort of questions they get asked when they're in the training sessions.
Yeah, I guess it just builds an extra level of credibility if they can answer something on the spot rather than saying, like, I'm going to come back to you on that. And I went to the Salesforce bootcamp in the Gold Coast last year and did my admin course. And I can't remember the guy's name, but it was a gentleman from the US that works for Salesforce. And what I really loved about how he delivered the training was that he had an example for everything. So he'd tell you like how it could work, and then gave you an example of how it's worked in a business that he's worked in before, or how they use that particular product, or just gave you a real life business use case for why you might do something a certain way. And that just immediately made me think, you know, this guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. And interesting, when I used to teach that course quite a lot, and I would find that I would learn just as much in the course as I would hope the people I was teaching would learn. But it's because there's people in there, maybe, you know, 10 students, all from different companies, all using Salesforce in different ways. And they ask different questions, so it challenges you to, but also they offer information about how they've done certain things. And so I sort of used to steal their examples, as I'm sure that instructor has done. They're probably not all his own. I will. But you then can replay them to the next class who maybe has a similar question or wants to know how another client's done it. So it's a great way of sharing knowledge, I guess, within the ecosystem.
Sure. So obviously you have delivered training for Salesforce. How have has your business's expertise been called in by Salesforce over the years?
Yeah, so we're in Australia, New Zealand, where they're go-to partner for delivering their standard training courses. They also now, through the TrailEd, have a user adoption services business where they do training and change management type offerings. So typically Salesforce will sort of lead the work and maybe go in and set up the sort of do an analysis, so the training needs analysis of what needs to be done, and then ask our team to come in and deliver that. So we've been very fortunate through the partnership with Salesforce, some of the clients that we've worked with, you know, some large clients and enterprise-grade clients that maybe a small training business wouldn't ordinarily get the ability to work with those clients. So yeah, it's been great for us, and let's hope they think the same about the quality of the work that we've done on the projects as well.
I'm sure they do. And in terms of adoption, like what do you see as the biggest challenges at the moment that your customers are facing with they've just bought this shiny new tool and actually getting people to use it? Is that just down to training in your experience?
I think there's a few factors that are involved in that. One would be the solution being fit for purpose. So is how it's being built what they need it for? Is it too complex, not complex enough? Like sometimes when we're doing a phase of a project and, you know, like a 300-day project, they can't give all the functionality at once. So it's choosing the right amount to sort of hook them in so they can't then go back to their previous ways is probably important. And I guess another thing with adoption is people going back to maybe say a sales manager being okay with them still working in their spreadsheet and bringing their spreadsheet to their sales meeting rather than now using a report inside the system. So some of that needs to be driven from the leadership. So if there's, you know, a proactive leadership team who are embracing the change and then filtering it down, I think it works well. And then, you know, we always look for sort of early adopters within the organization who are maybe at the ground level to kind of bring everyone else. So I'll set a good example that everyone else can learn from. I guess for training at the moment, some of the challenges we're seeing is the fact that everyone's working from home. So that's, I guess, been good and bad in that I think people have been challenged by just joining virtual meetings generally. So there's always problems with audio or can I see you, can you see me type of thing. When you then overlay that with now it's a training experience, clients traditionally have not wanted, even though we've wanted to be able to offer virtual services, people have always chosen to do a more traditional face-to-face type option. So now that's not a choice. It's been great for us to be clients to sort of be forced down the path of doing a remote style training. And I guess what we've found is there's challenges with face-to-face where, you know, someone gets sick, they don't turn up, someone gets stuck in the lobby, can't get up on the lift. Well, the same can happen in a virtual training, you know, someone gets stuck in the lobby, can't get into the meeting, or they're just different challenges, I think. But what we have discovered, and people are constantly surprised by, that they can get the same outcomes through that medium. So a remote training session can be as effective as, you know, doing the face-to-face, I guess. So it's interesting to see how people are moving down that path and how they, you know, can have a large-scale adoption where you're relying on people to engage through a different medium to get there.
Yeah, it's interesting. People can't point the finger and be like, well, the training was done remotely because, you know, it can work. But is there like in your experience, and has your team found that there's a kind of maximum amount of people that you can have engaged through video before you kind of start losing the value?
Yeah, so we would typically still want it to be interactive. So that would mean that people are doing some hands-on activities so it's not a one-way communication where the instructor's there just talking, demoing, and everyone's switched off and they disappear. So the people have to be engaged with the session. So in order to make sure we can get around and support everybody, I would say it's a similar number to a classroom setting. So we say 10 to 15 is a good number to have in a classroom for that reason, one instructor to support people if they get stuck or have questions along the way. Same in a virtual scenario, sort of that 1 to 10 to 15 is a good number for them to be doing some hands-on activities as well and having a chance to sort of have their voice heard.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point because I actually had breakfast with someone this morning and we were talking about like collaboration and how people now think that because it's through technology, you can have more people working on the document than if it was like, you know, you wouldn't have 50 people in one room trying to work on a whiteboard. But because it's through technology, everyone thinks, right, we can just scale the numbers of people that can touch this or can benefit from it because We don't need to get them all in one room. So yeah, it's I guess trying not to replace the what works, right? What works is 10 to 15 people learning at once, not 50 people just because we can have 50 people on a video stream.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So your business is, as you were saying, kind of over 8 years old now. What do you most love about being a business owner?
One thing, it's probably the hardest I've ever worked in my whole life. But because of that, I've also find it's extremely rewarding. And for me, I've felt like it's, you know, I've always thought, well, would be doing an MBA be an amazing thing to do? And then I think, well, I felt like I have just been doing an MBA. It's a real life one. I remember when I first started, I had to send an invoice. I'm like, had a bit of a panic attack. I don't know how to send an invoice. What does an invoice look like? Now I'm very okay with sending invoices. The more the merrier.
I hear you. I definitely hear you.
So for me, I guess the thing I love most is the journey that it's taken me on. I think it's naturally challenged me in ways that I maybe wouldn't have ordinarily got challenged if you're in doing a role. I've had to wear many, many different hats. Some things I've avoided or haven't enjoyed doing, and that's sort of part of the course. You know, one thing I've sort of had 12 months maternity leave, and one thing I've come back and started to do more is sort of work more on the business rather than in the business, and that's been a big shift. So I spent so long working in the business and you sort of can't see the wood for the trees when you're doing that. And now I've been lucky to be given some space to think, well, what else can we do? How do we move forward? Things like having a budget. Who knew that you could have a budget? How do you do a budget and how do you keep to the budget? So I think when you're in the business, you have a general sense, and I was doing a lot of work myself, so I always knew we were okay.
Sure.
Now when it's not me, they're doing the work and being as close to it, you need other tools to make sure that we're doing okay. And so I've had to, I guess, grow myself in ways to make sure I can function like that. And, so that's been awesome.
And did you find it easy to delegate? Like, was that an easy thing that came as you grew the business? Because obviously you were the first person in the business and you know, the success has come from the foundations that you laid. And then when you bring people in, it's like, it's kind of, you have to take it's a risk, but also you have to take that leap to be able to grow and put the foundations in place that enable you to go on maternity leave and things like that.
Yeah. And I think, no, a quick answer. I'm not good at delegating, but I think being forced, you know, having a child force me to have to be hands off. And that's probably been the best thing in terms of the ultimate step of delegation. And you know what? It's running way better than it was when I was leading the business. So I think it says a lot for delegating and sticking to your strengths. And I think, you know, I used to do things in all different ways, but that's just because I know I'll get to the same outcome, but it's more interesting if you do it a bit differently along the way. But how do you ever hand that over to somebody else? Because they need to follow the steps. And if you sometimes do step one and three and sometimes you do two and four, well, I know that's okay, but it's not something that's easy for someone else to follow. So that was probably a big lesson in terms of handing it over. And the Sarah, who we have running the business at the moment, she is amazing at following the process and putting the right steps in place and being consistent, whereas I'm probably more inconsistent with that. So, yes, I'm a big supporter of delegation. I did an entrepreneurial program actually several years ago, which was sort of learning about, you know, how to work more on the business. And one thing they were saying is as soon as you do something twice, then write it down. As soon as you're going to do it a second time, you should write it down so, you know, someone else can. You can start handing things over. So we went through a bit of an activity in the last couple of years where we started to have, and we set up in Salesforce, we have process records where we document how we do things. And even now I find it's great to go back to, because I've been out not doing things for a while, and I have to go and set up an opportunity like, oh, I haven't done this in a while. So we can rely on, you know, information we have in terms of steps to follow. So I think that's it's great. So yeah,
sure. And what if we look forward, like what are you most excited about for what's to come from the business and the ecosystem?
Yeah, I guess part of this pandemic has been traumatic and heartbreaking for a lot of people, and we're lucky, I think, in technology that technology has been something that people need to use more of than less of. So it's been rather than just survive, if you're in a technology industry, you've sort of been thriving in this environment. But for me, it's exciting that training and the concept of a remote training offering is something that we're being sort of given the opportunity to make amazing. Whereas before, we might not have had that opportunity because people weren't choosing or having to choose to do it. So I think, you know, our team last year did a project where we traveled to 73 locations across 6 weeks with 9 different people. Imagine the logistics of trying to get 9 people to 73 locations and hire cars and fly and all these things. It's like, that's huge. And even the cost involved in that, which adds no value other than, yes, someone's physically there in person. But if we can create an amazing experience where we can do some of this remotely, to me, that makes our business a lot more scalable.
73 locations. That was all in Australia and New Zealand?
That project was, Australia-wide. Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Well,
yeah. And Sarah made an awesome song, which, you know, I've been everywhere, man. And she rewrote it with all the locations that we went on that project. And sung it at our Christmas party.
Oh, well, we'll have to see proof of that. We'll have to get her to do it on LinkedIn or something.
Yes, I'm sure we can encourage her to do that.
Well, look, thank you so much. It's been really enjoyable hearing about the journey so far and excited to see kind of what else is to come. Because like you said, I think, the market is there. For disruption in terms of not having to be there physically, and it'll be exciting to see how you leverage technology to continue adding the value that you do.
Which one thing I'll add is internally about, I think I'm really proud of, is within our team since, you know, COVID turned up, we've set up quite a lot of internal sort of, we call it crowd culture. And so we have lots of different activities. 3 times a week, we have a half an hour like coffee catch up where anyone who's available at that time, dial in. And what we've done is we have a topic and a structure, so everyone gets to talk. And it's been fabulous for me, who I haven't worked closely with some of our team because I've been out for a little bit. And so it's a really awesome way to get to know people. We don't talk about work. It's literally half an hour, talk about your weekend, or is it bring a joke, tell a fun fact. And I think it's been amazing to keep our team feeling connected. And then we also do a trivia. So we have Kahoot, which is a tool we're actually starting to bring into the remote classroom, which works excellent for training. But also we have it as a trivia once a month. We're on a Friday afternoon. People grab a drink, sit around, and we've done one in person, but mostly we're doing them virtually. And it's been, I guess it's been excellent to find different ways, because we're normally a team who's distributed anyway. We're not all in the office at the same time. Everyone's out and traveling or on different client sites. So it's been wonderful to feel, I think, over the 8 years, this is the most connected I think we've ever felt as a team. Well, considering we're not to be together, which is interesting.
Yeah. And if anyone is listening and wants to reach out and find out more about the business or more about the role of a trainer and the challenges or kind of tips and tricks that you would offer, where's the best place to kind of reach out to you?
Yeah, we have for jobs, we're open to any applications, but we have a dream job email address at Train the Crowd. But on LinkedIn, anyone who's myself, Sarah, is it Martin Dunn, he's our delivery manager. Between the 3 of us, if you want to reach out, we're more than happy to have a chat. Martin's been amazing at ramping all of our team on their certifications. So he's a great person if you need help or advice on how you get certified or what the right channels to go through. Sarah's got an interesting journey herself from being a consultant all the way through to now she's running a training business. So, yeah, and I'm always open to have a chat. So, yeah, feel free to hit us up on LinkedIn.
Well, thank you very much for your time. And, yeah, look forward to seeing what the future brings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.